What's up, fam? Welcome to This Connected Podcast. I'm Catholic.Dad. Today, we will be talking about different situations and points of views about faith, life, and whatever comes along the way. To not necessarily agree, but again, definitely be listened to. This, of course, is from my perspective and those of my guests. You're welcome to agree or disagree, but we hope that you hear what was discussed and feel like this connected.
Different points of view and highs and lows, a new perspective everywhere you go. Open up your mind, drown out the noise, and see if this connected. And see if this connected.
Our society today is going through a lot. With the COVID-19 pandemic, lockdown, and the protests has left many people questioning what's going on in our world, our community. Disagreements arise among friends, among neighbors, and what is it that we are to do? In our series of Who I Am, we look at who we are as a person and how we see each other. When we look, do we see Christ in the other? And do others see Christ in us? The topic we are going to discuss today on this episode is a difficult one. One that I believe, as my mother always says, have both ears open so that we can hear what is truly being said. I want to welcome to the podcast our guest today that requires some courage, you know, as my mom would say, you know, some balls. There are officers, peace officers, who have accepted my invitation to talk and answer some questions from you, our listeners. And there are two sergeants from law enforcement agencies here in California. Welcome to the podcast. And would you mind, you know, please introduce yourselves and tell us a little something about you?
I guess I'll go first. My name's Carlos. Married, father of three boys, two teenagers, and one little guy, who, by the way, will be celebrating a birthday in the next few days. Like you said, been in law enforcement now for just over 25 years. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Malik, and I'm a sergeant. Currently assigned to internal affairs, and I worked a variety of assignments, including patrol and child abuse. And I was born and raised in Compton, and I had a lot of experience with law enforcement growing up, which is what shaped me into this profession. And I'm excited and I'm looking forward to speaking to you.
All right. I just want to say that because of the COVID-19 lockdown, we are totally making sure we're like 6 feet apart, we're wearing masks. I didn't even have to put my pop filters on here because we have our own pop filters. It's called a mask. But you guys ready for some questions from our listeners?
Sure.
So we're just going to dive right into it. You know, cut to the chase, as we say. So first, one of the questions, always, since you guys are law enforcement, why did you want a career in law enforcement? With the things that are going on now, you know, there are still some young people who are our listeners who are interested in law enforcement, but I want them to hear why you wanted a career in law enforcement.
Sure, I'll go. As a kid, I was always attracted to mysteries, so I always wanted to be a detective. However, my family did not approve, so my mother wanted me to be a doctor. So I went through high school and even through college planning to be a doctor. However, I still had the burning itch to be a police officer. And to back up a little bit, I went through a phase where I didn't like police officers. In my neighborhood in Compton, California, the police were corrupt, so to speak. They were taken over by the state. So it kind of gave me a bad taste in my mouth. However, I didn't know the officers personally. And being an athlete, I got to meet some of the officers who became my coaches and my mentors. And that totally changed the way I viewed the profession. And so as I got older and was able to make my own choices, then I reverted back to what I always wanted to do, which was being an officer.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. How about you, Sergeant Carlos?
For me, I would say it wasn't until I was about maybe 15 years old that I became interested in a career in law enforcement. And for me, some of the motivating factors was the excitement that comes with the job, but also that desire to, and it sounds cliche, but, you know, to want to help the public, to do something positive with my life, and the satisfaction that comes from doing so. So for me, those were the main factors in choosing this profession.
Now, you both mentioned the fact that, you know, Malik, you had a bad viewpoint of police officers, but it was your personal experience with people who helped you out, or you, mm-hmm. and you got to know some people. And then Carlos, you just said that, you know, you wanted to help people. You know, that's not necessarily what people, I think, view law enforcement, police officers in today. So I want to ask this question. Do you believe the current environment today, the current environment is anti-law enforcement? Why or why not?
I believe that that it is, but it's not. I think the narrative and the topic of the day is to be anti-law enforcement. There were so many people who either on social media or even in person during the protests that had anti-law enforcement signs. But I can say just as much anti-law enforcement hate that we got or rhetoric that we got just as much love. People are coming to us on the side saying how much they respected us, but it just doesn't seem popular to come in public and support law enforcement. So I think that overall you can say that it's anti-law enforcement, but there's a lot of love still out there.
That's so interesting that you say that, because we don't see it. Mm-hmm. We don't see it in the news. We don't see it in people's posts. We don't see it in social media. So my question is follow-up question for that. From your perspective, which do you think is more of the driving force that portrays cops as being the enemy? Because that's what we're seeing in social media. That's what we're seeing in posts. At least that's what I'm identifying. That's what I'm seeing. And just to be honest, you know, if I was a young person looking at that, we're going to look at the terminology that's being used for you guys. And even my term saying you guys, it separates me from you guys mm-hmm. as different. So from your perspective, which do you think is more of the driving force that portrays cops as being the enemy? Is it social media? Is it the entertainment like movies and shows, or the news media? Yeah, Carlos.
For me, I would, without a doubt, have to say that the number one culprit here is the news media. And, you know, you mentioned right now, is this a tough time to be in law enforcement? For me personally right now, I think I'm going through a very difficult time because of all the negativity. But I think I need to remind myself that just like the media, that's what I'm looking for. They make the public believe that the majority of law enforcement is bad. I think they're having the same effect on many of us in law enforcement and making us think that the majority of the public does not support us. But I think in both cases, the opposite is true. Like Malik said, there is a lot of people. In fact, just, you know, one of the things that, because of all the negativity, I've kind of stopped listening to news, watching TV and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But one of the things my wife told me of earlier today is that she's starting to see how there's a lot of pro-police rallies going on throughout the country. I wasn't aware of that. So it shows that there are, you know, a large part of society that still support us. But I think that the media kind of sways our opinions or perceptions and, you know, makes us think the opposite.
Interesting. What's your take on that, Malik?
You know, I would believe that it's a little of social media as well as the media. I think a lot of times, especially now with cell phone video and surveillance video, we're capturing these incidents, these isolated incidents where an officer is doing something that most likely they should not have been doing. And unfortunately, a lot of times, or it resulted in serious injury or death to a person. And it seemed that we harp on those things. Yeah, it definitely should be highlighted. But with social media, I mean, it's retweeted, it's, you know, it's on YouTube and thousands of views, and we focus on that. So a lot of times people use that as their sole narrative. They'll pick a particular incident and say, hey, you know what? All cops act the way this cop acted. And myself, speaking to my colleagues, very, very, very few of us agree with what the cop did. So it's never something where we're like, oh, yeah, he did the right thing when a cop is accused of doing something wrong, especially when it's on video. So I think a lot of times it's the narrative that's been played out. And again, the media, they put their spin on it. I've personally have been on the news when they reported something completely false. I mean, a 15-second clip and it's completely false. So I'm a firm believer, and they put out what they want you to, what they want you to hear. And an example was, I believe in Ferguson, they had the riots and everything going on. They had all the news media out there showing the riots. Right across the street, they had a food drive. A church was giving out food. It was one reporter over there. And that just goes to show you that they want to focus on the things that excites us, that divides us. And there's tons of officers out there doing good work. And I always said that if they showed a loop of the officers mm-hmm. doing good things, if they showed that on CNN and all the other news stations, if they showed those on YouTube, it would probably shape the paradigm of a lot of people. Unfortunately, we're only seeing the negative incidents. So that's what I believe.
But we're not saying that what those things that happened to George Floyd and the things of what people are posting, we're not saying that they're not true. Mm-hmm. We're just saying it's that it's not the whole narrative. Exactly. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Because I think there's a lot of anger and frustration when I speak to people and when I hear people, is that this has been going on for ages. And especially when people are speaking with Black Lives Matter. You know, Malik, you're Black.
I'm Black.
And the thing is, have you ever looked at that and says, I'm Black, and this happened to me, and for someone to say to you, now you're on the other side, and you're a sellout. So how does that make you feel? I mean, Carlos, you're brown. So you're the brownest guy I know, and bald. And, you know, that's probably just because you are turning bald. But how does that make you feel? Both of you guys would say, you guys are sellouts.
I don't take it as being a sellout. And you're definitely feeling divided when you see things like that and the common occurrence, and especially when the underlying factor is another Black person is killed. I read the same narrative that other people are reading. And I always tell people, being a police officer is my occupation. When I get off work, I'm a civilian. I'm a Black man living the life as other Black people in my community, because of where I work doesn't make me any better or afford me any other privilege. And a lot of people, they don't understand that. They think that we join the police academy and all of a sudden we metamorph into a holy person, or that we can't make any mistakes. And so I remember having this discussion where a protester was telling me that I didn't understand what it meant to be black, because if I did, I couldn't be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And my response was, that's the reason I'm a police officer, is because another black person pulled me to the side, and this person was my coach, my basketball coach, and told me that this is something that I can do. You know, I had to lose friends. My family was up in arms about it. And so I made that choice. And not one day goes by that I regret making that choice, because I know every day I put my badge on and the effect that I can have on other people, that it's worth it. It's worth it. So I'll take any name that you call, but I challenged the person, like the person I was speaking to. I said, get to know me. Find out what I do, right? Find out what I do and what I've done and the people that I've helped before you make a judgment, because you don't know what I went through. You don't know my background. Trust me. So
thank you for sharing that, because mm-hmm. that opens up a lot of eyes. You know, and you said that I lost my train of thought, but you said something about, you know, this wasn't a profession that your family wanted you to be in. But a question for either of you is this: knowing that your families didn't want you to be law enforcement because of the negative stigma that's went in there, why do you feel there is that negative stigma towards law enforcement officers? I know the narrative is out there, but why do you feel that people still look today in 2020 still negatively that law enforcement officers are racist, and it's a racist organization, or it's systematic racism, or mm-hmm. systemic racism?
Well, I believe that the narrative is still there, because again, we see these incidents, right? And a lot of people will say, hey, we see them over and over, way too much. And we tend to dwell on those. So I would challenge people, get to know local police officers, because it makes a difference. I think communication is huge. Having those chats with people, and that was one thing that that I always liked to do when I was on patrol, is I like to get out my car and speak to people, because a lot of times, even just small things, tactics, why do we, you know, we have our hand on our gun when we approach a car on a stop. Once I explain to them and say, hey, you know what? We don't know who we're walking up on. Little things like that. And I think it's huge, that communication and having dialogue. And when it seems like when people are educated and they hear the police officer's perspective, then they tend to be more receptive. They open up more. But when they don't, when they're listening to just their friends, or they're listening to social media, or they see a news headline, and they just go on that. They go on that. They don't bother speaking to an officer. I'm like, there's police officers everywhere. And I know it's a little intimidating, and it's very hard to do. So a lot of times for me, I like to break that ice. I like to just start a conversation. Most of the time it's about sports, or, you know, what they're wearing or whatever. I like to have that conversation, because, and it seems to me, once I break that ice, that they are receptive. They are receptive, and they like to ask questions. Hey, why do you guys do that? And I have zero problem explaining it. Zero problem, and say, hey, this is why, you know, this is why we put handcuffs in the back instead of the front, or why we put you in the back seat, not the front seat, because they have questions like that. It might seem funny, but it's not funny, because people have that, or they'll see as a third party, or they'll watch a video and they'll say, oh, they shouldn't have done that. Or why did the officer hit him in the face? Or why did the officer shoot him? And why didn't they? I get asked, how come you guys don't shoot him in the elbow? You know, and I have to explain our use of force policy. And I just think that a lot of the negative stigma towards the profession comes down to education and communication. So I think once we open that dialogue and we begin to educate in each other, part of it is the officers too. You know, officers, we don't know it all. A big thing too is we get a lot of our intelligence from our community. And we got to get the officers to be receptive as well. It's a two-way street. So I can't sit here and say that, you know, the community has to learn the police policies without the police officers mm-hmm. learning the community, because it's important. It's vital that we know our communities that we work in, because different communities have different issues. So again, it's very important for that.
So in my field, we used to have to take these cultural sensitivity classes to understand different cultures and how different traditions and how people perceive it. Now we're having to take classes with generational sensitivity, mm-hmm. because a person who's traditional or baby boomer or mm-hmm. a millennial or a Gen Z reacts differently to how we dialogue with them. And so those are some things that we have to take training on. But I'm pretty sure you guys take the same things. You guys take, what types of trainings do you take to or have to take or are required? Are they required or are they mandatory or are they electives that I take this course on sensitivity?
For us, there's a lot of training and it's mandated by the department. A lot of it has to do, like you said, you know, cultural awareness, also mental illness, homelessness. There's been a lot of, you know, training with regards to that. And then also a lot of training recently with regards to de-escalation. So all of that definitely is high up on as a priority within law enforcement, in hopes of, you know, there's always room for improvement. And so that's one of the ways that they're hoping to accomplish that is through extensive training in those areas.
Yeah, and I think one huge training that we take is implicit bias. It was a mandated training.
Explain that to some of our listeners because they might be in high school.
So, what
is implicit bias?
Okay, so implicit bias is pretty much acknowledging your not necessarily stereotypes, but prejudices, which we all have. A lot of times we refuse to acknowledge them, but we have them. So it's pretty much acknowledging them and seeing how they affect the way you do your work. You know, for instance, if for some reason you don't like tall people, right? And then you get into an argument with the tall person and you react a certain way that's different from the way you would have reacted to a shorter person. So to put that in police terms, obviously we can take it to race. Right? We can take it to race based on your background or your family background or where you grew up. You might not like a certain race as much as you like another. Right? And it can come off in the way you talk to them, the way you enforce the law. And unfortunately, it happens. And it's something that, and I think it's a good thing because it's something that we all have to do. We have to acknowledge it. We all have to acknowledge it because if you're saying that you don't have any biases, then I believe that you're lying to yourself.
Exactly.
I mean,
I've always shared my biases. You know, I grew up, my mother tried to put us in neighborhoods that she felt were going to be advantageous for us. So she pursued this whole thing where she wanted to move us in predominantly white neighborhoods because of the opportunities were there. And she was right. There are better schools. I remember in fifth grade, she moved us all the way to Burbank, and then I got bused to East LA because the busing thing, mm-hmm. it backfired on her. But when I became professional and working in the hospitals, that was my very first moment where I worked with a lot of black people. And I had my own biases. I had my own fears. I had my own distrust that I grew up in. Because as a Filipino, it's kind of thing. It's like, well, they're black. And I had never been in Pomona. The only time I'd been to Pomona was at the Pomona Fair. and it was different. But it was my experiences with people of different races that got me to experience the beauty of those races and the individuality of each race and to appreciate the differences instead of trying to make everyone the same. I got to give a shout out to one of my mentors. She was an LVN. Her name is Miss Clydia. I call her Miss Clydia because she's the one who taught me, don't call me Clydia. I'm older than you, son.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, from henceforth, I called her Miss Clyda. She's an African-American lady who says, I'm black. Totally confused me. I was like, which one do you want to call me? Which one do I call you? And what she taught me was respect for myself and for each other's race, the individuality of each one, that we're not all the same. But it's beautiful that we're all different. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't ever have that opportunity to be around other cultures and other races, yeah, I would still have my biases because I never went past that. And the reason why people say, why did you move into your neighborhood in South Fontana? Well, you know, people who know me already know this story. Well, my neighbor was black, married a Filipina. My neighbor across the street was Mexican, married a white woman. Other neighbors, they were black. And other people next door, he was Mexican, she was Japanese. And when our kids all played, guess what? They all looked Filipino. And so I'm like, I want this neighborhood because it's diverse. Mm-hmm. And everyone gets together. So that's my personal experience with that. But I want to go back to a question because you guys are approached with a lot of anger, especially right now, where you go to work, you know, you leave your home, and all of us leave our house saying, okay, well, I'm going to go to work. I'll see you later, honey. I want you to tell us how it is for you that when you leave, and for some of you guys, you might be on behind the desk, but for the people who are going out into the streets, what's the process like when you leave work, go to work, and then have to come back? Tell us how that is. And then as a second question, how do you handle the anger and aggression coming from individuals towards you who don't know you personally, but because you're wearing that color blue?
I think the second question is probably a little easier to answer that. Like you said, many times you deal with people who have a lot of anger towards you. That's where you have to kind of use your skills, what they call verbal judo, try to, you know, again, all part of that de-escalation training. I've always told, you know, when I was a field training officer, every day you go to work, it's so easy to get into a physical altercation with someone. It takes absolutely no effort. What does take a lot of effort, a lot of skill, and it's something that I always pride myself in, is that ability to talk people into going to jail and not having to fight them to put handcuffs on. That's a lot harder. And so you just got to, you know, think about that. And be good at it. Otherwise, you're not going to last very long in this profession if you don't develop that skill. You're going to get yourself physically hurt, or you're going to get yourself in trouble. It's very important. It's a extremely crucial quality that an officer needs to possess, but more so these days.
It's kind of like when in my line of work, where in the hospital, patients do go off. And their staff was out, take them down. Mm-hmm. And there are people like me who are short, small, and mouthy. It says, no, let's just talk. Because I know I'm the one who's going to get hurt. And then you see, as you said, you're not going to last in this field. And you see individuals who work in my field who are my age and are hardly able to walk because they've sustained so many injuries. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying to me is you're not wanting to go down on the ground with anyone. No. That's not the point, right?
No,
not at all.
So the same question for you, Malik.
I think just based on where I grew up and how I grew up, I learned to not take it personal. And also, like Carlos said, you got to know how to talk to people. And a lot of times the anger is directed at either a system, and sometimes I call it false anger, because they don't even really know what they're mad at. They're looking at you, but they're mad at something else. Meaning they're mad at the video. They're mad at, you know, they're mad at Minnesota PD, or they're mad at CHP for giving them a ticket. And so Yeah, I just personally, I don't take it personal. I also speak to people as if I was on the other side of it. And I think that's a big thing too, within our law enforcement, is that we have to kind of get away from the us versus them mentality. And I see it, especially with a lot of younger officers, I see kind of like the challenge. And when someone's directing anger at them, they take it as a challenge. So they feel like, hey, I have to be a little bit bigger and badder than you. And most of the time, it doesn't end well. It's usually ending with someone going to jail or somebody getting hurt, or what we call a use of force incident. Because for me personally, I just take it as it is on the surface. I don't internalize it. I try to deflect it. And if I can, talk my way out of it.
That's interesting because, you know, as I sit here with you guys who are older, when I was in my 20s, when I was in my teens, I would have never thought in my days that I would be sitting next to two law enforcement officers, two peace officers, unless I was doing something wrong, right? Because I honestly can say I have never been in front, aside from my friends, I've never been in front of law enforcement officers when I was doing something right. I get a ticket, CHP pulls me over, I'm going 80 miles an hour, it's my fault. But I'm pissed. I'm pissed at that officer because he caught me. Mm-hmm. I was like, and my wife, I remember I got pulled over and she said, well, that's your fault. Why are you so upset? I was like, because I got to pay that. Mm-hmm. I got to pay the piper. And so, but I've also had experiences with law enforcement who are complete buttheads. I remember I was 28. I was in Rancho. Not saying which PD. But this guy took my license plate off and then said, if you don't come back with the correct sticker on there, I'm going to come to your house. I'm going to arrest you in front of your children. And I'm like, well, that's not right. Mm-hmm. I'm a very peaceful man. But I was pissed. And I came back with the right stickers because he said, and when you do, if you do, I'll personally put the plates back on. Now, I'm older to be able to address that. And when he did, he handed me my plates. And I said, well, you said you were going to put them on. And he did. He was a younger peace officer, very young, which adds to my question, you know, how old do you have to be a peace officer? And how much training do you have to have? And how much education do you have to have? Because that is a question that people are asking. They need more education. They need more training. And my thing is, I think you guys do have a lot of education. I think there's a misperception or a false narrative that you guys don't have an education, mm-hmm. and that you don't have enough training. So let's speak on that. Let's speak, Malik, on that, on how much education you need, how old do you have to be, and how much training and constant training you have to have.
From what I understand, that we have to be 20 and a half before we apply and 21 by the time we get on the job. I think we need a high school diploma, maybe GED. But our training is very thorough. We have an academy, but after the academy, we're mandated by California Post to continue our training and update our training, including firearms, law, and a variety of things. So I do believe that there is a misconception about the education portion, because a lot of people choose law enforcement as a second career. I mean, I have colleagues who they're professionals in other careers prior to joining the department. I have multiple colleagues with advanced degrees. So I do think that can be a misconception. I'm not a training coordinator, but I do know that we are constantly training, and even firearms, we have to qualify, or we have to shoot every other month to maintain our skills. We have perishable skills training throughout the year, and it's constantly updated. So I don't think that we lack in any training.
Yeah. And I want to ask Carlos this, because you had said earlier, we had talked about, you know, why don't you just shoot him at the elbow? Why don't you just shoot him in the leg? And I remember having a discussion with Carlos at one time, says, well, you know, do you shoot to kill? And you put me on and corrected me regarding what it is and why you shoot the way that you shoot. It's not to shoot to kill. It's, you said it's shoot to what?
Stop. Shoot to stop.
Shoot to stop. Because I think that is, again, the false narrative that even I had, that when a policeman tries to shoot at you, he's trying to kill you. And I think that's a false narrative. I think that's my bias, that when someone has a gun, they're intending on killing you. So explain to me a little bit what shoot to stop means.
So again, many people have that misconception that when you know, police officers shoot someone, that they're shooting to quote-unquote kill. Our department trains shoot to stop, and what that means, stop the threat, whether it be coming at you, you know, with a knife, with a 2x4, whether he's shooting at you with his own firearm. Unfortunately, the quickest way to stop that threat is to shoot them in a vital organ area, whether it be, you know, the upper torso, or last resort, you know, a headshot. That's what's going to stop the threat. But it's not the training or the intent to kill that person. Unfortunately, like I said, shooting someone in vital organ is highly likely that they are gonna die. But the training is shoot to stop. And so sometimes the expectations of the public is a little unreasonable, and a lot of times just has to do with lack of knowledge. So, like Malik said earlier, you often hear, well, why didn't they shoot the gun or the knife out of his hands? Or why didn't they shoot him in the knee? Or, you know, why did they have to shoot him? You know, and that's one, like I said, it's where it's most likely to stop the threat. But then also, got to keep in mind that shooting, it's a special skill that it's not as easy as it seems. Hitting that target, even at close range, it happens frequently where both officers or suspects or you know, anyone that's gone to the range and is not very proficient will know what I'm talking about. It's easier said than done. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be aiming for the guy's knife or the guy's gun, chances are you're going to miss, and then now he has that opportunity to, you know, hurt you or hurt someone else. So again, the you're shooting to stop, and you know that, unfortunately, you know, the upper chest or headshot is what's likely to stop that threat.
So it's not like in the movies where we see like police officers who can like shoot something in there and shoot a nickel and put a hole through it.
Another big misconception or a big lie that you see is like in the movies, they'll shoot someone once and the person goes flying backwards in the air and lands. No, you've seen some of these YouTube videos. The officers are firing, you know, upwards of 10 rounds or more.
Well, that's another question I have, because, you know, some of the things that are posted out there is, why do they have to shoot him 5 times? Why do you shoot him 10 times? Why did that person get shot so many times? And why did that person get shot in the back? Because we have this conception, it's like, well, you don't shoot people in the back. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to hear from you guys.
With regards to that, there's so many things that come into play, and a lot of times the public doesn't realize. So, for example, you got a vehicle pursuit, and at the end of the pursuit, the guy comes out of the car with a gun, starts shooting at the officers. Say there's, you know, 2-3 police cars, each one's got 2 officers in there, so you're looking at least 6 officers. This guy's coming out of the car, starts shooting. All the officers aren't going to be thinking to themselves, okay, let me see if my partners over here are going to shoot first or not. They're just thinking, hey, this guy's trying to kill me or kill my partners, I'm going to shoot. The 5 other officers that are there are thinking the exact same thing at the exact same time, so they all start shooting. Mm-hmm. It's not that, why did all 10 officers or all 5 officers have to shoot? It wasn't planned that way.
So it's not like, oh, Malik, you got this.
Yeah. And unfortunately, sometimes people don't realize that. Same thing. Why did they have to shoot him in the back? Well, if this guy is shooting as he's running, sometimes he's going to turn his body or what have you. Things happen in split seconds, and that may be a contributing factor as well. Sometimes people don't think about that. There's what's called the delayed reaction, lag time and stuff. So sometimes the brain is a little slow to react. And so this guy's shooting at me, I'm shooting back, but in the time that it took my brain to tell my finger to pull the trigger, that suspect now turned his body, and so now that round has been fired at him, and it hits him, you know, in the side or the back or something.
So it's you know, each and every one of us has a fight or flight mechanism, and you have to train yourself. Whereas me, as a non-law enforcement officer, if I hear gunshots going off, I'm fleeing. I'm going the opposite way. And you have to train yourself with fight or flight. I need to go in and fight instead of the rest of us. And like, well, I'm running the opposite way. That's, you know, the questions, the answers that you guys have of having to shoot someone, that's traumatic in of itself to listen to. And you have to train yourselves to have to shoot to stop. So my next question is kind of related to that, because I do believe in trauma-informed care. You know, that is traumatizing enough in of itself to think about, to hear of shooting. But can you describe, you know, a very distressing situation in which you remain calm and collected so that you can do your job?
Yeah, I can talk about a particular incident that I had, and this was an incident where a colleague of mine was ambushed. He was ambushed by some gang members. I happened to be around the corner when it happened, and there were four different shooters, and just my colleague and his partner, and myself. And this particular location where it happened was a tactical nightmare. It was a T intersection going up a hill and flanked by sets of apartments. So luckily one of my colleagues was able to neutralize one of the threats as additional police officers arrived, including myself. The other suspects took off to unknown locations. So we had three unknown shooters. And not only that, but we had citizens who lived on that street. They were throwing things at our police car, and they were throwing from up because the location was on a hill. So they were throwing things from higher ground. They were hitting our cars with oranges, eggs, things from the refrigerator. So the initial call came out as the officer was down. So as I arrived, I was trying to figure out which officer was down, and I found the officer, like I said, was my colleague, and he was kind of in shock. And thinking back, it was just a nightmare. So I realized, because he was kind of out of it, especially after having take that guy down, the suspect down, so I had to step up because it was just way too much going on at the same time. Again, I had to corral the citizens and take care of that portion. We still had three outstanding shooters. I had to get on our radio and direct resources into, because another thing that I didn't say is at the same time this happened, those gang members had just killed someone else. So I was actually on my way to the other homicide when this happened. And without even getting into too much detail, I can tell you it was serious enough to where it's featured on Gangland.
Mm-hmm. So. And the question there is, you know, so there's going to be someone's listening to this and says, well, why didn't you guys just leave? It says, why did you continue to pursue? Or did you continue to pursue? Is that even an option? Because people have these things. It's like, well, you know, they're shooting at you. You didn't leave.
There is no way we can leave that situation because, again, our two officers were ambushed.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people out there in podcast land, they were shot at by four separate shooters. Their police car was shot at. Actually, it was an undercover car, but they were shot at, and they had no choice. Yeah. So there's no we're going to drive out of this. We had to stop and we had to handle business right then and there.
I think one of the things that one of my friends said to me was, even if that person who does not like me, I still have taken an oath to protect and serve that person.
Yes.
And that's hard because mm-hmm. for a lot of us, you know, you see someone who cusses at you and you're like, well, up yours, and I walk away and I'm good. But you got to walk back into that every single day and probably even see that same person. And if that person gets attacked, you're like, you know, you're going to say, well, he deserved it. Yeah. So trauma-informed care. When you guys are traumatized after that, having received all that trauma builds up this thing inside people where it becomes us against them. What things do you guys do, or what things does the department does, or the organization? What do you guys have to go through when you've gone through that trauma? Is there something you have to take time off? Do you have to go back and readdress that? Do you have to go to therapy? Is that mandatory? Is that an option for you? So that you don't go back there, you know, upset at the world and taking out on some innocent person.
Yeah, these for our department, if you're involved like in a shooting or something of that nature, before you're allowed to go back, you know, on the field, you do have to visit the department psychologist and get cleared first to know that everything is okay. And then there's some follow-up visits afterward as well. But yeah, they don't just, you know, allow you to go. It's not like in the TV shows or the movies where they get into that shooting and later that same day they're back out in the field arresting, you know, someone else, someone different. It doesn't work that way.
Man, that's my favorite show, Mel Gibson. You know, go out there. So, we're going to bring this out because it needs to be spoken to. What are your thoughts about Black Lives Matter movement and what people are saying, about this? I just learned this, you know, ACAB, A-C-A-B. It stands for All Cops Are Bad or All Cops Are Bastards. So let me hear what your take is with Black Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter movement. You know, hearing from both of you, I'm gonna say it. Both of you, all of us are brown. You know, Malik has a little bit more melanin than you, Carlos. But you know, but all of you guys, all of us are brown. So, what's your guys' take on your thoughts on Black Lives Matter movement, and what are people saying? You know, with ACAB.
Well, with regards to the ACAB thing, ironically, I just learned that earlier this week.
It's because you're old.
Yeah, I am. I think, again, like I said earlier in the podcast, right now with all the current atmosphere, to me, that term, to me personally, has a negative connotation. And it's been said before, you know, it's not Black Lives Matter, but All Lives Matter. It sounds cliche as well. But again, I think all lives matter, you know. So, and again, right now, that term I associate it with the anti-police movement. So for me, it has a negative connotation right now, to be honest.
Oh, well, I'm going to put it out there. You know, sometimes when people say Black Lives Matter, it's because that's what's being looked at that moment. It doesn't say that all lives don't matter or brown lives don't matter. But when someone says Black Lives Matter, it doesn't take away from any other cultures. It's just focusing on that specific mm-hmm. issue. Someone said to me one time, it's like when we're talking, you know, about a specific type of cancer, it doesn't take away from the other cancers, like all cancers matter. But right now, my point is, what I'm trying to get at is breast cancer is my issue right now. And all our focus is on breast cancer to resolve that, but all cancers matter. I mean, it's a bad analogy, but that's how someone got me to understand what that meant. Because I did have issues with all lives matter. I never said that all lives didn't matter, but Black Lives Matter. It's like, well, and again, dialogue with that, is having this, having that dialogue. What does that actually mean? But Malik, what's your take on that?
Well, I believe that the Black Lives Matter, the saying is very important. Obviously, for me being a black male, that I can attest to a lot of their feelings, their anger, and, you know, just being living the life of a black male. And if you don't, then it's kind of hard to understand. As far as the movement, I'm not really too familiar with their manifesto or their ideologies. I've spoken to a few of them at police commission meetings, just trying to get their take on things. So again, it's always important to communicate. And so far, the conversations that I've had have been positive. I know that they don't really like certain people in our department. But again, so for me to hear the words Black Lives Matter, it's not necessarily a negative connotation, because I do believe that in certain aspects, it needs to be said. But I think the problem that I have is when it's selectively directed, meaning that when it's only directed at police officers or it's directed at white police officers, I think that it needs to be a general term and that it needs to be applied in other places too. So, for example, when we have murders in Chicago or other cities of Black Lives Lost. And I know you brought up the example of cancer, and I know people bring this up too. They say, hey, you know, we're only talking about when black lives are taken by cops. But why is that? Why is, you know, we can burn the city down when one person is killed by a police officer, but yet we have 100 shootings over Father's Day weekend and 14 people dead, and no one makes a perp. You know, no one says anything. So for me, and that's my personal belief, I believe that, again, the message needs to be said, because there is definitely systemic racism. There's tons of subtleties that if you don't live the life, then you won't understand. And it's kind of difficult to explain. But as far as the movement, I would like to see it branched out and, you know, and covers more things or focused on other things than police officers, because there's tons of issues within our own community that we can deal with. And I know people have a problem with that because, again, they're selectively choosing to direct their anger at police officers. So Malik's personal opinion is, I don't agree with being selective as far as that goes.
Malik, do you think the protests are helping the black community or hurting the black community?
I think the protests are definitely helping, because it's bringing light to it. Again, there's tons of incidents, and a lot of times they're subtle. I mean, as a black male, you know how to, you learn how to navigate and how to deal with certain perceptions that people may have of you. Whether it's the way you talk to people, you almost, especially if you're tall or you're big or you're dark, or you have to make sure that the person that you're talking to doesn't perceive you as a threat. Certain situations, like in the store, you have to make sure that you're showing your hands, that you're not taking anything or even being pulled over by a police officer. You know, the way you talk. I mean, because even myself, like I said, when I'm off duty, I'm just a citizen, a black male. So I go through the same things that another black male go through. And they would argue and say, hey, you're a cop. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything. They don't know I'm a cop when they're pulling me over. Mm-hmm. So I still do things. I put my hands on my steering wheel. I let them know, hey, I'm going to reach into my glove compartment and retrieve my registration and insurance. Things like that. And again, and it's hard to explain because you have to live the life to understand it. But I do think the protests are helping. And one thing that I liked about the protests is, again, is being able to start that dialogue. What I didn't like is a lot of the anger. For instance, I saw people carrying signs and saying, you know, F police officers or F-12 or whatever. But then the other side of the sign said, we want peace. Mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, we gotta be on the same page here. You can't send mixed messages saying, hey, I want us all to work together, but we hate you at the same time. So I do think that that dialogue, or the beginning of the dialogues, have started. It's going to be interesting to see how we move forward on both sides.
Now, I think people have again, with a false narrative, have on both sides have made misconception of putting together the protests and the riots. You know, and for me, the protests that were going on, peaceful protests, is not the same as the riots that happened afterwards. How do you feel about is that destructive? The protesting that leads on to rioting, that are taking over blocks of cities. Is that considered protest, or is that considered riotous behavior?
I think what happens, and not just with these recent protests, but the exact same thing, like, say, for example, during the Lakers celebrations or, you know, team sports like that, there's always that group out there of opportunists who are just looking for that, you know, again, that opportunity to wreak havoc, to cause chaos, to go looting, you know, things like that. They don't care anything about the movement or change or none of that stuff. They're just seeing that as, hey, this is my chance to go out there and do what I want and get away with it. So that's, unfortunately, it's damaging the agenda of those who want to conduct peaceful protests for positive change. I think we sometimes forget that it's two groups, but the bad group kind of jumps in and messes it up for the good ones.
Mess it up and ruins the message. So the message, that's a lot going out there. And it was a lot more earlier, and it's kind of dissipating now, but it's still the message out there with regards to defund and what's the other one? There's
abolish the police.
Abolish, defund, and reform the police. So do you believe that it's right to try to defund the police and allocate those funds elsewhere? Start with Carlos.
I think the police department is already stretched far too thin as it is. So with all this talk about defund the police, all it's going to do is bring down the numbers, make it hard, make a difficult job even harder. And then even worse, with this talk about abolish the police entirely. I mean, I can't believe anyone would even entertain ideas like that. Mm-hmm. I've always said there's bad apples in every profession. Law enforcement is not excluded. And even during these recent riots, people need to realize that if it wasn't for those officers that were out there on the streets, you know, putting their own lives on the line, who knows, the city would have burnt down to the ground. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who are stopping. The unfortunate reality, there is a lot of evil in this world. And without some sort of force to fight that evil, and again, I keep saying the same thing, it sounds cliche, but it's the truth. We need police officers. And people need to realize and not be misguided by the media. People need to realize that the far majority of law enforcement officers out there are good men and women trying to protect, you know, the public, trying to do good, and that the bad ones is just a very small percentage.
And a follow-up to that is, you know, in my own city, you know, someone posted 59% of the city's budget goes to police, and they're like, well, what's that about? So how can we, can they say, is it okay for them to say, well, then why is more over half the budget of a city goes to law enforcement? You know, and I think, you know, how do you speak to that, Malik?
Yeah, I think it varies from city to city. And based on the needs of that city, obviously you have some larger agencies versus some smaller agencies. So I would believe that they have to trust their council as far as the budget. There's people that get paid tons of money to do that. I don't know any particular city's budget, but I believe if they're going to allocate funds from the police department, then they better have a very good place to use those funds, mm-hmm. and something that makes a difference. Because like Carlos said, when we start talking about removing money or defunding police officers, then it's going to come down to public safety, and people got to be very, very careful about what they choose, because it might sound good on paper, but then how is it going to be when that guy is climbing through your window and it takes a police officer an hour to get there? And, you know, things like that. And like I said, they have to really do their research and understand what you're asking for. Because, again, I'm not versed in budgets for cities as far as it goes with police departments. But I can say that when you start removing money, that it does have an effect. I mean, even the morale of the police department, resources, when you start removing cars, you're taking away cars, or you're removing officers from the street. Again, it's going to come down to public safety. Who's going to be responding? And it's all good until you're the victim.
Yeah.
Right? And like I said, it sounds good on paper until you're the victim. And then you're going to understand, hey, we need those guys.
How is the morale in your departments?
I would say through the ground. For me, like I said, I've been in law enforcement just, you know, a little over 25 years now. And I got to say, it's never been lower. It's pretty disheartening. Just, again, I don't even watch TV, listen to the news anymore, because I'm just, it just makes it even worse. All this talk about abolish the police and defund the police, and everyone wants to blame the police for society's ills. And I think that's one of the other problems, is that at an early age, people are now being taught that it's not your fault, it's someone else's fault. Let's blame someone else. No one ever wants to accept responsibility for their actions, nor does anyone want to hold anyone accountable. It starts at an early age, and that's what I'm seeing, is that just no one wants to accept responsibility. It's always the cop's fault. What about that suspect who chose to fight the police? You know, they say, oh, he was unarmed. At every call that an officer goes to, there is always at least one gun right there. So that suspect may not have had his own gun, but there is a gun there at every single call. And many times, you know, a suspect has been shot by police because he was trying to take the officer's gun. So, you know, it's a tough time right now.
I agree with you. One of my last questions, this comes from a seminarian. He said, how are you feeling in regards to all the opposition against all cops? And he adds, how can we pray for you?
I think, speaking for myself, that it is disheartening. And as a normally optimistic person, I still see the good coming out of it. Again, for me, it's important that we begin to speak about these issues, because a lot of times they're kind of kicked to the side or they're buried. And even amongst officers, we're starting to see a little division, whether it's politics or you know, the way that our powers to be, our politicians, they're responding to certain things. And it seems like it's just getting divided and divided and divided. And then that's not even including the community. And so if I was to ask for prayer, then I would suggest that we pray for just unity. You need to find some common ground, because it's easy to divide us. We can divide each other tons of ways. Like I said, politics, religion, race, rank, generation, right? Because we have a lot of young officers. We're dividing ourselves so much. So I would pray that we find a way to unify each other. And then once we unify each other, being able to put out the message that we're intended to put out. And again, because that's why we all sign up to do what we do, which is, to help the community and save the community, and vice versa for the community. We have to unify each other. It seems the same way that, we're divided as a community. The election year, and who likes this person and who likes that person, and what are you wearing? So as far as t-shirt or hat.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I believe that we got to find a way to take it back to where we started, go back to our morals, and then move from there. Because if we listen to the media, we listen to social media, we listen to people talking, whether they're activists, pastors, or whoever that's giving messages, if they're trying to divide us, then I think that we should try our hardest to move away from that. And it's real easy to, these guys are very good speakers. they're orators. Mm-hmm. And they can get you to follow them. But I just challenge people to hear the message. Hear what the underlying message. I don't care how good they sound. If they're trying to divide you and telling you that you're better than this person, or you're doing right and they're doing wrong because you believe in this, politician, then I challenge you to stay away from it.
How about you, Carlos?
For me, I would say, again, like I said earlier, the job of a law enforcement officer is not an easy one. So with regards to prayer, first and foremost, I would ask prayer for our safety, so that each and every one of us can return home to our families every night. So that's first and foremost. But again, it's not an easy job. There's a lot of expectations that are placed on officers. So I would also ask prayer for wisdom, so that we are able to make wise decisions out there. Along with that badge comes a lot of the authority, a big responsibility. So I would also ask for compassion, prayer, so that we have compassion when dealing with the public. We don't know where that other person's been or what they've been through to put them in the situation that they're currently in. So compassion is extremely important. Patience, prayer for patience, because this job without patience, it's impossible. What else? I think those are the important things.
Okay.
Safety, compassion, wisdom, and patience.
Those so my last question to both of you, because this is in the Who I Am series, the word I am is mentioned over 300 times in the Bible. It's a wonderful name. It's the name of God. So my last question to you guys, aside from anything else that you want to add to this podcast, your statements is, who are you?
I think I might have mentioned this the last time.
You
got to
start that with, I am.
I am. So I am a father. I am a husband. I am a son, a brother, a friend. And a law enforcement officer is just what I do for a living. Oftentimes, friends or family will introduce me to someone, and the first things out of their mouth, this is Carlos, and he's a cop. That's irrelevant. Before a cop, I'm all these other things. So that's who I am.
Super cool. Malik.
I am also a father, a husband, and I am a black man that has came from an agency where, or a neighborhood where our police weren't friendly or they weren't doing the right things. But at the same time, I was able to see through it and see the good that they did. And I think it mirrors today's day. And I bring that up because, again, it's almost reciprocal. Because now, as a police officer, there are kids out there who see YouTube or they see the protests and they feel that the profession is not worth it. They believe that, again, it's a us versus them. And I felt that way. I definitely felt that way. I did not like the police prior to meeting them. As a collective, I didn't like them. And so I am just a man on a mission to educate everyone that I can, whether it's colleagues, whether it's community members. But I definitely like to speak to young people because I don't think it's fair that they grow up with a preconceived notion of the law enforcement profession without knowing the real. I feel like if they understand or if they learn, then they can make an educated choice. It might not be for them. They can make their own decision. They can choose to be whatever they want, attorney, basketball player, whatever it is. But I think by educating them, then they think they can make their own decision. So that's just me. I am willing to speak to whoever I come in contact with. I've never changed. I'll always be the same. And that's my mission. And again, and I preach it to the guys that work for me, the guys that work with me, anyone in the community that I come in contact with, because I think it's important, because that's what changed it for me. And if I can change it for one person who can change it for someone else, then I think we're on the right track.
Thank you for that. Wow. You know, the scripture, Matthew 5, verse 9, it says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." You know, a lot of people are asking questions that I believe we are all asking. Why is it taking so long for justice? Why are we still facing injustice due to racism in our country? Why are we failing? How can we be better? These are questions our nation is reckoning with and must face. I hope that you were able to take something away from this podcast. I pray that what you've heard will allow you to be open to dialogue with the people you disagree with and come to a consensus that benefits our community. I want to thank my guests, Sergeant Carlos and Sergeant Malik, for having the fortitude to come on and answer the questions from our listeners. I also want to close us in this one prayer. It's one of my most favorite prayers. It's a prayer of Thomas Merton. And it goes like this. My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. Amen.
Amen.
That is all we have for this episode. If you like what you heard, please don't forget to rate and subscribe to this Connected podcast. And please give us a review. Email us your comments and questions to catholic.dad50@gmail.com or follow us and send us a DM on our Instagram @catholic.dad. You can also support this podcast and the contents it provides by becoming a patron at patreon.com Patreon.com/disconnected, or you can Venmo us at, or send us a gift, like a dollar or two, through our Venmo code, CatholicDOTDad. Your donation is completely to support the youth of whom this Connected podcast is affiliated to. Remember, live a life of holiness. We will be praying for you. Please pray for us. And most importantly, be blessed and be third.
Different points of view, and highs and lows, a new perspective everywhere you go. Open up your mind, drown out the noise, and see if this connected. And see if this connected.
This Connected podcast is brought to you by The Cabin. Want to get away and get some peace and quiet and rest? Yes, rest, but not too far away from home or the city. Want to experience a true log cabin feel in the mountains? Well, I have the recommendation for you. The Cabin is a 2-bedroom, 1.5-bath that will do just that. With a beautiful wood fireplace lit and a glass of wine, you are sure to relax. With easy access from the main highway, private parking, easy access with stairs to the entrance, fast Wi-Fi, a full-size kitchen, and all the essential amenities will make your stay a memorable experience. This cozy log cabin was built in the early 60s with its original wood fireplace and a newly transformed deck with beautiful views of the San Bernardino Mountains. So, book your stay at The Cabin in Running Springs, California. The Cabin, located in the San Bernardino Mountains, is a beautiful place to see the beauty of God's creation. I have known the proprietor of The Cabin for many years. She has always supported the youth and young adult ministries of her community, as well as this podcast. Check out The Cabin on Instagram at TheCabin2021. Again, that's at TheCabin2021. T-H-E-C-A-B-I-N 2021.